The next matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Sexter. Counsel, as you're squaring yourselves away, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes of time for the relator if you choose to use it. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument and be mindful of the timing restrictions indicated in the lectern, which I can see is already at a very high, it's at a near high altitude. There's a button in the front that allows you to lower it to match your height at your convenience. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may. I said appellant, I guess in this case I meant relator.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Christy Horman. I'm the Chief Deputy Steele County Attorney, for the appellant here in this case. Your Honors, this case boils down to really three topics that I want to address here with the court today. The first of that, given that this is a pretrial appeal from a district court order, first being the demonstration of critical impact that's required, as well as then the what the appellant believes are the flaws in the district court's finding here. I'll begin with the critical impact here. Obviously, under that standard, the appellant must show that the trial court's ruling was erroneous, as well as the fact that the order had a critical impact on the ability to prosecute the case. Here, under the case law, the state can demonstrate that the critical impact of the excluded evidence by showing that excluding that evidence significantly reduces the likelihood of successful prosecution. It doesn't have to just completely bar the successful prosecution of the case, but just significantly impacts it.
First, we look at the admissible evidence available to the state.
Correct.
And so, as I see that, there is the testimony.
Sure.
And then you have the other evidence seized in the warrant, which are the three white claws, green folding knife, clothes worn by Sexter, photographs, DNA swab from him, but I don't think in this record that we have the DNA sample found on the blue and white towel was from Sexter.
Correct.
In this record.
And I think the appellant's position is under Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 110.01, the record is comprised of any documents that are filed within the trial court or the district court. That would include the criminal complaint in this matter. And there is a paragraph in that complaint that talks about the results of the DNA testing that was done on the towel. Specifically, that complaint states that, and it's on page 2 of the complaint, that forensic testing was completed on the white cloths located in the red shed. Semen was identified on item number 2, one of the white cloths from the red shed. That's the blue and white towel that's at issue here in this case. DNA analysis showed that Sexter's DNA matched the DNA present in the sperm cell and non-sperm cell fractions located on that item. So it's the appellant's position that this court can rely on that criminal complaint, given that under the rules of appellate procedure, any documents that have been filed with the trial court up to this point would qualify as the record. And so that's where really that evidence comes from here to demonstrate that the DNA evidence, what it is and where it was located in this case. So here, the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that evidence that is particularly unique in nature and the quality is more likely to meet the critical impact test. And I think the case that both appellant and respondent rely on here is In Re the Welfare of LEP, and that's cited in both briefs here. But going on, then the Zanter case also addresses that, whether the exclusion of a particular piece of evidence would significantly reduce the likelihood of a successful prosecution depends in large part on the nature of the state's evidence against the accused. And so what we have here is this is DNA evidence. It's very important to the successful prosecution in this matter, because without that, the evidence that the appellant has is really the statement of the victim here, the alleged victim here in this matter. So this boils down to making it a he said, she said case in regards to the criminal sexual conduct charge that is contained in the complaint here. There is the knife that was located pursuant to the second search warrant. That applies to the second degree assault charge that's contained in the complaint. So that's really a separate issue here, and the court can look at it as the specific charge and the evidence that relates to that. So also the court can examine the inherent qualities of the suppressed evidence itself, its relevance, and the probative force. That's in State v. Edrozo, E-D-R-O-Z-O, at 578 Northwest 2nd. 719, that's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1998. Here, the DNA evidence obviously is particularly unique. That's been found by the courts in other cases as well. And the suppression of that towel does have a critical impact on the prosecution here. As I stated before, in a respondent's brief, they argue that, well, the victim is 100% certain of the identity of the suspect here, so it really doesn't have any bearing. Well, that's not necessarily the only reason that DNA evidence is important. It corroborates the victim's testimony as well. And this case is going to center very much around the credibility of these two individuals. Specifically here, the DNA on that towel would provide corroboration to the alleged victim's testimony. And as the court can see in the transcript, at the end of the hearing, there was mention of a parity motion hearing that was going to be scheduled because there's going to be an attack of this alleged victim's credibility based on her diagnoses, her status at the time of this offense. So to say that because she knew 100% who the attacker was, this has no bearing or no effect on the prosecution isn't necessarily true, because it is credibility is central to the prosecution of this case, and therefore it does have a critical impact on the state's ability to successfully prosecute the case by allowing this evidence to corroborate what the victim is, in fact, testifying to here.
What does the appellate record show about diminished capacity, if any? I'm unclear about her particular
At this point, I don't think the appellate record shows anything regarding that. The only thing that I'm pointing out is that there was a request for these records, so I think it's a fair assumption to say that credibility is going to be an issue here. But the record itself at the appellate stage doesn't contain a lot of that information. There may be some information in the police report, but
well, I guess maybe I should say, what was it part of the district court record prior to the appeal being taken?
I don't recall the exact timing of when we had the parity motion. There was a parity motion, and before we filed this hearing or this appeal, so I think that may be considered. There were some documents that and records that the district court did allow to be disclosed pursuant to that parity motion.
And that occurred before the hearing on the motion to suppress?
No, it occurred after.
Sorry, okay. Yes. And going back to the forensic testing of the towel, I mean, am I correct in understanding or assuming that the more important information to be derived from that is that there's semen on the towel, not just DNA, because DNA could have been saliva or perspiration or something else, right?
Correct. The fact that it is semen and was his sperm cell fraction,
a witness would say that, semen.
Witness would say that, yes, at trial.
Sperm cells, okay.
Yes, and that's contained in the complaint, that language about the semen and sperm cell. So based on that, Your Honors, the appellant does feel that there is a critical impact by the district court suppressing this DNA evidence, that it's not simply an identity issue, it's not simply a corroboration issue.
I'd like to cut to the sort of the Fourth Amendment issue, sure. Since time is short, but I'm sort of unsure about the source of law to analyze this. It seems to me that the particularity clause of the Fourth Amendment is used to determine the validity of a warrant on its face. But what we're talking about here is not so much whether the warrant is particular enough. No one questions that. If anything, we have an issue about it being very particular. But isn't this really about the execution of the warrant? You know, in other words, what an officer, what things may be collected by the officers in execution of the search based on a given warrant.
Yes,
Your Honor. And what's the leading case law on that?
Your Honor, I think the case law is that there's honestly, I could not find a specific case directly tied to this issue or a very similar issue. And I think that's where the appellant's reliance on the Miller case and arguing the similarity or the language that's used within that there are aspects of the evidence that's seized that are similar to what's listed in the warrant would be the characteristics are consistent or reasonably consistent. That's really where the case law comes into effect or the law comes into effect is when something is described in a warrant, how specific does it have to be in order to be seized? And so in that Miller case, I know respondent argues they're not similar at all, but it's not so much the underlying facts as it is the findings of the court that in these characteristics that are substantially similar in the way that it was described by the victim and the way it was included in the warrant, that allows the officers to, just because it isn't exact, the description isn't exact, that they can still collect that evidence under the warrant because it has some of those similar characteristics. And in this case, specifically, the way that it was discarded, the way it was described is that it was thrown down in a corner. If the court reviews the record, all the photographs that were included as part of the omnibus hearing, the only rag that was collected that looks to have just been tossed aside is this rag, this blue and white striped towel that was collected. The others have items on top of them, appear to have been there for some time. There was about a two-day delay in the report from when the incident happened.
Am I correct that neither the victim nor the warrant itself refers to the white cloth as a plain white cloth or exclusively white cloth?
Correct. All that the victim said was it was a white dish towel-like cloth. Didn't say plain white, didn't say mostly white, just referred to it as a white cloth.
So that brings me to my point. I think of a dish towel as being not bigger than medium-sized, and this was a beach towel.
Well, I don't think the record supports that it was a beach towel. The testimony from the witnesses was they could not give a description. I think respondent described it as a beach towel and relies on it as a beach towel, but the record that we have at this point does not have an exact size of this cloth or towel that was collected, and I think that's very clear from the record. So I think to categorize it as a beach towel would be incorrect given the state of the record that the court has before it at this point.
I haven't checked to see, but is there a photograph of the towel in the record? I know it's described as I gather it's white and light blue?
Correct, Your Honors. There is a photo within the record of where it was found before it was collected. There is not just an overall picture of it after it was collected and spread out or laid out. That's why we don't have the exact description of the size of it. But it is a towel that appears to have been thrown down in a garbage can that is white with a very pale blue stripe. We're not talking about a navy blue stripe on a towel here. It's a very pale blue stripe. And the texture of the towel also is consistent with what would be a dish towel type rag that was described by the victim here. So here that the assertion, I think in the district court's reliance on the fact that this is somehow a plain white rag, the error that the district court or that the appellant feels the district court made here is that the findings within the district court order are inconsistent with themselves. Because the district court refers to it as if the towel was purely or mostly white, it would have been easily covered under the search warrant. And then three of the four towels here that were collected were not purely white, and they weren't suppressed. So here, the fact that this towel isn't purely white should not then make it suppressible. And so you can't really reconcile the district court's findings here that these other towels that were mostly white or not purely white aren't to be suppressed, but this one is. Here that based on the district court's ruling, it would suggest that it's better to just get a generic description from a witness of an item because the district court is saying that if it was mostly white or described as mostly white or light colored and not purely white, that it would have been fine under the search warrant. And you just can't That just can't be reconciled with the case law that allows for flexibility. And the district court addresses that issue, that flexibility can be allowed in its order. but then only applies that flexibility to some of the items and not this item. So here what happened is the officers that were collecting the items focused on the towels only with some degree of white coloring, with the exception of leaving behind a red towel that or rag that that they found as well. So the victim's description that was given cannot be taken as a very specific description, more as a general description here, that it's a white dish towel-like cloth. I mean, we don't even have a very specific size or anything like that. So I think that respondent's interpretation that this is a very specific description given by the victim is misplaced. It's actually more of a general description. And under the pool case, that's where the flexibility comes in to allow the collection of those items. I think in looking at the items that were collected, they're all consistent. The testimony of Detective Okins was that he collected this item because it was consistent with what was described by the victim. And I think that includes how it was discarded, where it was found, and the overall description of it here. Even if this court finds that the particularity clause was violated somehow here in this case, or that this towel shouldn't have been collected, the appellant argues that the plain view doctrine would also apply here. And really, the district court kind of just was dismissive of that whole argument and didn't put a lot of analysis into it. And so, I see my time is up. Am I allowed to finish this briefly? Or?
It is. Well, you will have 5 minutes
okay.
of rebuttal time.
I'll address it then. So, thank you.
Counsel for respondent. How do you work this way?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Rogaszewski. I represent the respondent. I think this case hinges on a critical impact, and I don't think the state has met that burden. I refer, and I've got about 4 points on that. The first point is in their statement of the case, it says, does the judgment or order to be reviewed dispose of all the claims by and against all parties, including attorney's fees? Answer, no. If no, state something. They state the order deals with suppression of one piece of important evidence. There's other evidence that would allow the state to proceed to trial on the charges alleged, but this suppression order greatly affects the state's case. My second argument is let's look at the state's case. Under Minnesota Statute 609.347, Subdivision 1, the testimony of the victim need not be corroborated. She's 18 years old. She's going to testify that she was abused since the sixth grade. She has lived with this family since she was 6 years old. We have relationship evidence. That is trumping what we call Spriegel evidence in all the sexual cases that I've encountered here in the last about 5 to 6 years.
Is the fact that there was a sexual encounter, the allegation that there was a sexual encounter a matter to be in dispute at trial? Does it appear that that's going to be a disputed question, or is that a...
The whole sexual assault is in dispute.
Well, I don't mean just assault, a sexual act. Or is it...
Sexual act is in dispute.
Okay.
There's no consent defense.
Yeah, this is not a consent defense. This is it didn't happen.
So the DNA evidence is pretty significant on that issue.
The DNA evidence is... First of all, this is the first time we've heard anything in the record. There was nothing in the record, nothing in the briefs. Now we hear the first time at argument that you can take a look at the complaint. The complaint
The complaint's available to everyone. You're not surprised by what's in the complaint.
Well, what I am is if we make an argument that it's devoid in the record and they don't mention it, I think it's... Well, it's late, but anyway, it doesn't matter. You're talking about what's in the complaint that a police officer swears to. You're not talking about the BCA document that tells you exactly what they analyzed and what was found.
Aside from that, I understand the procedural argument. If I can finish my question, the substance of your argument is what I'm addressing now, which is whether the DNA evidence of semen of your client is critical on the element of whether a sex act occurred?
No. It's not relevant.
It's not relevant?
No. Because it just says that there was semen found on this towel, and my guy excreted it. There's nothing about saliva. There's nothing about other DNA evidence from the victim. The victim, it doesn't even address that. You don't see the BCA lab analysis. You see a brief blurb in a complaint sworn to by an officer. You've got the testimony of an 18-year-old woman, not a child, talking about abuse from grade 6 all the way up to 18. You've got relationship evidence that's going to come in. You've got therapy records that are going to come in. Every sex case I've tried where you have a victim, you have therapy records.
But in
you
this
have
case,
corner house interviews. In this they case, have corner house interviews
in this case,
here.
In you have a victim who says a sex act occurred, a towel was used by the alleged perpetrator to wipe himself in a way that would suggest that there could be evidence on the towel. And I'm trying to get an understanding of why you believe that towel is, to use your word, irrelevant.
DNA evidence includes everything. When I touch you, I'm going to leave my DNA on you. My skin cells are on you.
But your semen is not.
There is nothing from the victim found on this cloth. Nothing.
This so is your argument would be, I just want to understand your argument. Your position is that as a matter of the Minnesota Rules of Evidence, if this went to trial,
they would admit it.
Can I finish the question? Is it okay if I finish my question?
Sure.
Your argument is that towel would be irrelevant and inadmissible.
It would be admissible. Its weight would be extremely minimal because there is nothing on there from the victim. This is a farm. This is a junky shed. The transcript describes it as a mess. You get pictures of it. It's a mess. And that's why when you look at the evidence that normal sex cases have, when you have a allegation that this sexual abuse occurred over time, you have tremendous testimony from an 18-year-old girl, not a child, but she says it happened when I was a child, when I was in the sixth grade. And then you have a corner house interview, and that therapist comes in and describes the corner house techniques about not asking suggestive questions. Then you have the therapist who this child is now seeing the minute the allegation is made all the way till the time of trial. Basically, you have all that evidence supporting the victim, and the relevance of one rag is not there. It's this critical impact. Not only do they say it in the statement of the case when they knew that it was in the complaint, they get up here and argue about a parity motion. I looked at the exhibit list, and the exhibit list doesn't have our parity motion on it. That came after this matter. What you should look at is you should look at Exhibit 4. That's the exhibit of the towel in the garbage pail that becomes a beach towel. There's no question if you look at it, it's not a dish rag as described by Deputy Waltman on page 18.
She I was says, going to ask about the description beach towel, which I noticed in your brief several times. I mean, was there testimony at the hearing that did any witness describe it as a beach towel or any document?
No, because they didn't bring the towels. They didn't bring the evidence to conveniently to the omnibus hearing. And number two, they testified, even though they picked them up and put them in an evidence bag, they couldn't recall the dimensions. And they couldn't recall the dimensions because they know what the issue is at the omnibus hearing. They know the issue is particularity of the search.
So on what basis, given the description you've just given of the record, would we adopt your description of this towel as a beach towel?
You can see it when you look at Exhibit 4 and you compare it to the Exhibit 3.
So if we look at it and we don't come to the immediate conclusion that it's a beach towel, we wouldn't use that description?
It looks apparent to me, and it looks different than Exhibit 3 and Exhibit 5, which are all the towels that were found. It's also interesting to note that the police officers indicated that they found other rags, but they didn't take them because they were of different colors. Well, did you take a picture of those? No. It just so happens that one red rag is in the picture of the two rags in Exhibit 5. And so they're able to say, well, we didn't take that red rag. Did you take any other rags in there that were of different colors? No, because they weren't white rags.
I have to say, Judge Johnson did bring a copy of the exhibit, so I have seen the copy, the image now. Would you disagree with the description that this is, contrary to what the district court suggested, in fact, a mostly white-looking rag or towel?
No, it's mostly blue. It's blue with, it's mostly blue, in my opinion, and that was what the district court found. I don't think the district court...
The district court said it was mostly blue? I didn't see that in the findings.
The district court's order is as follows. As it is, the towel in question can be described in a number of ways. It is blue and white. It is striped. It is textured. It is light-colored. It is not, however, plain white as described in the warrant application. Therefore, the court finds seizing the towel exceeded the scope of the search warrant and violated the defendant's Fourth Amendment.
Where did the district court come up with the plain white description, the adjective of plain, the plainness?
Because if you look at the officer's police report, that's how the victim described it to him in a recorded interview.
So the word plain was?
So, but I don't think we look at the testimony. I think we look at the warrant.
Well, correct, but you also, in the record, is the officer's police report where he relates what he talked to the...
But you're complaining that the officers exceeded the scope of this warrant.
Correct.
So why don't we look at the warrant to see what they exceeded?
The warrant says, as you recall the testimony is...
Well, the warrant says a white dish towel-like cloth used by suspect following the sexual assault, which is believed to be located in the red shed.
And then in the body of the warrant, it says that it was a white rag that he threw in the corner. If you look in the body of the warrant.
When it says dish towel-like, does that mean dish towel-like in size or in texture?
Well, when you describe it as a rag, the common definition of a rag is not a huge towel. When you describe it as white, and when you look at the officer's police report, and you look at the testimony in the hearing, the testimony was that Officer Orkin is the investigator. He got all the evidence because he talked to the victim. He calls on the phone to another officer so that they don't keep the judge waiting past the witching hour. And so all of the information comes from Detective Okren. The Deputy Waltman drafted the search warrant based on telephone call from Officer Okren. Okren looked at the warrant and then signed it. In his police report, which is our only evidence of a detailed conversation with the alleged victim, is that it's a white dish rag.
So, again, going back to my question, dish towel-like, is there any indication other than that description in the word rag that would indicate that like is referring to size as opposed to material?
Just in the victim's description of what happened when it occurred, she said that he grabbed a rag. He told her to grab the rag and wipe off his penis, and she wiped it off, and he threw it in the corner.
So to understand the impact at trial, I want to... Okay. You're representing that the defendant's position will be this incident never occurred. So I'm imagining the state's evidence would be the woman will describe the event as she has done to investigators. The officers, investigators will testify perhaps about the investigation and that she told them this story first, then they got a warrant, then they seized this item. the forensic testing corroborates her story to some extent. It seems to me that is a much more effective presentation of evidence than if the towel wasn't there. And your ability to cross-examine her about, you know, to call cast doubt on her story is diminished if the towel cannot come into evidence. Am I wrong in any of that?
The charge is he molested her from the sixth grade on to today.
Well, some of that abuse, I think, I mean, it was verbal and physical and so on, but it seems like we don't have sexual incidents until either this time period, I believe. If the state is trying to prove that this incident occurred as alleged, it seems like the state's evidence is much stronger. The defense's ability to cross-examine the witness to call the state's evidence into doubt is much less if that towel is in evidence. How would you disagree with that?
Because the DNA evidence just says this is a farm field. This is a farmer in a shed.
Right. It's semen. It's semen on a rag, not just DNA.
He's going to testify at trial. And unfortunately, some farmers masturbate, all right? And they masturbate in the shed. And they might have masturbated in a towel. Mm-hmm. And the BCA actual document says that there is no DNA evidence from the victim. The relative weight of it is going to be more for me than it is for her. The critical impact here is the testimony that this abuse...
So the towel supports your argument more than the state's?
In my opinion, it does, yeah. And what I'm saying is they even say that it's not a critical impact. All these cases that you get and all these cases that I've tried in the last 5 years, and a he said, she said, when the relationship evidence comes in and when Spiegel evidence comes in, and when you have the therapy records come in and you have it over a period of time and you don't have a child witness testifying that it happened one time, but you have an adult woman who's 18 years old that describes the sexual abuse, that's when you have a lot of problems. And you have a lot of problems saying that a 18-year-old made up all these stories from the sixth grade all the way up to now when she's a senior in high school. So the critical impact of this towel is nothing when you compare it to the other evidence that she has. And that's what you have. You have to look at what's significant. And they have a significant case, just like they said in the statement of the case.
Thank you, Mr. Rogoszewski. I think you've let you go about a minute over, but we appreciate your argument. Your time has expired. And counsel for the state, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honors. May it please the court, Christy Horman, Chief Deputy Steele County Attorney for the appellant. Just to address a couple of the things that the respondent brought up here regarding the critical impact. There's no guarantee that the other evidence that counsel has suggested would come in, the relationship evidence, therapist evidence, there's no guarantee that that is going to come in at trial or that that would even be offered by the state. So I don't think this court can rely on that at this point.
I guess while we're on the topic, has there been notice of Spiegel evidence?
No notice of Spiegel evidence at this point. There may have... Don't recall, I'd have to look in my file to see if a history of the relationship notice has been filed. There will be one filed in all candor to the court. I just don't know if that's been filed yet at this point. But the DNA that was found in this case is not just semen. It's also included in the complaint that there was a mixture of DNA, but that the mixture was not sufficient enough to determine who the other contributor or contributors may be. So this isn't just Mr. Sexter's semen on a towel in a shed. It is more than just that. And I think counsel's argument that this isn't relevant evidence is very misplaced. I have never tried a criminal sexual conduct case where DNA evidence has not been relevant. And I think that juries want to hear that, they expect to hear that. And in this case, I find it hard to believe that Mr. Rogoszewski isn't going to attack this victim, that there was no DNA evidence collected, if she gets up there and testifies about this, if this towel remains suppressed. So I think that it does have a critical impact as it comes down to that credibility attack and the state's ability to successfully prosecute the case. Now, I didn't quite get to the plain view doctrine here. I want to just touch on that here. And I was stating before that the district court was very dismissive of that, and I don't think that it gave that the district court gave this idea the attention that it would be warranted if the court finds that the towel should be suppressed under the particularity rule here.
How is criminality readily apparent?
I think based on the underlying offense that we have and the description that was given by the alleged victim here, she described this as a dish towel-like rag that had been thrown aside, thrown down in the corner. And as I stated before, this is the only towel that was in that shed that appeared to have just been discarded or thrown away, thrown aside. So I think based on the information that they have, there is, in fact, that criminality or the piece of it that is immediately apparent, given the knowledge that they have and the types of the type of offense that's alleged here.
And usually the type of evidence we look at in plain view cases is that there's obviously marijuana, it's obviously a gun, there's obviously a blood-stained shirt or knife, a photograph of a crime. I mean, a towel does not have those readily apparent indicia of criminality without more. Have you found a case that's close to this one?
Not with specifically with a towel or a piece of clothing or
not
something.
Not even towel
similar.
Or clothing, but a piece of evidence that doesn't itself suggest a crime.
Well, there are cases where it turns out to be stolen property, and I do cite some of those in my brief. And I think that if you have a TV in a house, that's not necessarily readily apparent, and that's, if you look, if there's more description that you have, or you're aware of a burglary or a tool or something like that, so more of along the lines of a stolen property type situation, where a drill may not be just readily apparent evidence of a crime, but if you have information about a burglary that occurred and a tool that's somewhat similar to that description is located in this house, then it would have that. And I think that the case law says that you need to look at the totality of the circumstances. And here, the information that the detectives and the officers have is that in a criminal sexual conduct case, I don't think it's that far of a reach to say that a person may wipe themselves off with something. It may that so that a towel may contain DNA evidence. In this case, we specifically know that a towel was used and that it was discarded by Mr. Sexter here in this case. And the district court's reasoning is flawed here in that...
Difficulty with your argument is that if the towel is not the kind of towel that was described in the warrant, if it was the type of towel described in the warrant, then its criminality may be readily apparent. If it's not, then the criminality is not readily apparent. I don't see how your plain view argument can possibly have any more strength than your warrant argument. It seems to me that if you lose on the warrant argument, I don't see how you prevail on the plain view argument.
Well, I think my position would be that just because it doesn't fit that description, that a towel could be evidence of a criminal sexual assault case, and so that therefore under the plain view that could be seized at that point. And just in one last issue here, in regards to the description given by the victim, and I stated it in my brief, I stated it here, but the description given should be taken as a general description, and I think Your Honor's questions have kind of alluded to that. Do we know that the description, is it for texture, is it for size? And I don't think we do know that based on that, so I think that needs to be viewed as a more of a general description here in this case.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. I mistakenly referred to the state's position as the relator, having had a cross-eyed look, apparently, at our calendar, where we do have a relator, but you are the appellant. Thank you for both of your briefing and your argument today. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Because that's our last case in our oral calendar, we're in recess.
All rise. I'm on the downside of this, like the backside of this.